Eric Weiner has a new book out. He's the guy who wrote The Geography of Bliss. This one is The Geography of Genius. And we're going to find out if the geography of genius and bliss coincide at any point. And we're going to go there, really, because it'll be perfect. Smart people, and it'll be paradise. He's in Silver Spring, Maryland with us right now, and let's say hello to Eric. Hey, Eric, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you.
So is there any place where the geography of genius and the geography of bliss coincide?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Very few. Most places of genius are not that happy, and most really happy places are not that genius-y.
Yeah.
Take Switzerland, for example. You know what Graham Greene infamously said about Switzerland?
No.
500 years of peace and stability, and what have they brought the world but the cuckoo clock?
Oh, yeah.
Which is actually a German invention, so the Swiss don't even get that.
You know, I think, wasn't that in The Third Man? I think, that line
correct.
Was in The Third Man.
Very good.
Thank
very
you very
good.
Much.
It was.
What do I win for that?
You win some Swiss chocolate. Congratulations.
Yeah, no.
The point is it takes a little bit of unhappiness to be creative, because I think all creative people and places are responding to a challenge. I really think creativity is a response to a challenge. And if you're living in paradise, wherever that might be, if it exists, you've got nothing to respond to, nothing to push against. So that's why there's very little overlap.
Being unhappy alone will not make you a genius, though, because I've tried that route. And...
Yeah, no, that doesn't work. I'll tell you the best answer to that question for the connection between sadness and creativity was what I heard from researching my first book on happiness in Iceland. Mm. I met an Icelandic composer who was very successful, very creative, but he also seemed happy, and this was confusing me. His name was Hilmar. So I said, Hilmar, what's the deal? You're both creative and happy. And he said something I'll never forget. He said, yeah, I'm basically happy, but I cherish my melancholia. And I like that, and I think that says a lot. All creative people, even if they're moderately happy, always have this side of them that is melancholic, and they don't reject it. They do cherish it.
Yeah, so melancholia is a good engine to have, driving your quest for something new?
Some discontent, I would say, with the status quo, because what is creative genius but kind of rocking that boat? And if you're captain of the boat and perfectly happy with it, you're not gonna rock it.
See, so I see a real problem for this current age and those beyond, because now we would treat that as depression. Someone who's melancholic, it might actually be a good thing because he's thinking about all kinds of things and turning them over, and they're mostly depressing, let's face it. But now we'd be treated for depression, and we'd have no geniuses as a result.
That might be true, although I think the manic depressive genius, of which there are many examples throughout history, they do more creating in the manic phase than the depressive phase, to be honest. And I think when you're truly depressed and you're Brian Wilson, you can't get out of bed, you're not producing much. So I think cherishing your melancholy is good, but giving into it all the time, not so good.
Yeah. And Brian Eno, the biggest genius currently in the world? This is what I get from your writing. You keep mentioning Brian Eno no matter where you are. You're in China, you're in Austria.
I know, he kept coming up.
Yeah.
He talked about, I talk about Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground being an example of what I call a multiplier. Now, their first album sold like 30,000 copies, which is not very much.
No.
But as Brian Eno said, everyone who bought one of those 30,000 copies started a band. And he's joking, but not really. And
as he famously said,
Yes, exactly. Like so Lou Reed's influence on the rock scene is much greater than just the albums he sold. And throughout history, you see that. You see these people who are multipliers. Yeah, exactly.
I really enjoyed the book, I will say that I was disappointed in Greece and China somewhat.
Oh no!
You know why? Because some of it is, or you go look and you go back, or you go back to Egypt or something, and you say, "Where are they now?" There's so much of that feeling. These are ancient cultures and so brilliant and so advanced, and what happened? But where that all changes is when you go to Scotland. Is that your favorite part of the? To me, that it must be, because that's a magnificent chapter.
Yeah. It's pleasantly surprising. I think not too many people actually know about the Scottish Enlightenment, or is it sometimes called the Scotch Enlightenment because they drank an awful lot. But it had a profound influence on this country. A lot of the founding fathers visited there. Benjamin Franklin was a frequent visitor. Thomas Jefferson loved Edinburgh. And we don't know that so much. And it was so unlikely because it was what one historian say, it was dirty, poor, quarrelsome, and alcoholic just before its golden age. And it was perched on the edge of the world. And it was so unlikely, but they rose to the occasion. And for about 50 years, there were no more brilliant minds in the world than those to be found in Edinburgh, Scotland.
Yeah. So how did that happen? That's a good question, right? Because it seems totally unlikely that Enlightenment would occur in Scotland at that time.
Couple things. One is they had that port in Glasgow, and they were open to the outside world, and they went back and forth to France, not so much England so much, and they imported ideas. It was a crossroads for people going to the colonies and going to mainland Europe. So all these places, including Edinburgh, had that sort of cross-fertilization. And they kind of had a chip on their shoulder, you know. They had something to prove to the English who had just conquered them, essentially, that they were every bit as good. And that chip has been helpful in lots of places, including Silicon Valley, when you have something to prove. And I think the biggest thing is, you know, I was sort of joking about the Scotch, but not really, because they would drink and they would engage in something called flighting. Have you heard of flighting? F-L-Y-T-I-N-G?
Yeah, not till your book.
Yeah, okay, but now you have. It's an old Scots word, and it means, and I quote here, ritual humiliation of your opponent through verbal violence.
I can relate to it, but I didn't know it existed.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what your show's about. But,
somewhat.
Yeah, and when I heard that, the Scottish historian who told me, I said, well, Tom, it sounds brutal. And he says, oh, it is, with a glint in his eye. But the point is that you could talk about anything openly and freely with your friends and your enemies. And after a good flighting session, all parties would head down to the local pub for a pint or five, no hard feelings. And, yeah, that kind of freewheeling conversation, an interdisciplinary conversation where even if you're not an economist, you could mouth off about economics because the field had just been formed by Adam Smith and it was still young. And I, you know, as I delved into Scotland, I thought, wow, I wish we were more like that today.
Yeah. And isn't part of it, though, too, the whole Scottish can't be done, it can't be done philosophy?
Yeah.
They always start off with the premise that it can't be done.
Right. And then they do it anyway. It's, you know, Captain Kirk's, you know, saying to Scotty, we need more warp drive. And Scotty says, it can't be done, Captain. And then he does it anyway. They have a very practical strain of genius in Scotland. They're very much into improving everything. And you saw it in medicine. It was, if you were sick in the late 1700s, you wanted to be in Edinburgh because they had the best medicine in the world and the best medical school in the world.
Yeah. And how did that happen?
Again, I think it was that combining the practical and the theoretical, and medicine's perfect for this because you need to have a theoretical understanding of how the body works, but then you need to apply that. And they were like, you know, why are we sending our students to learn medicine in London or in the colonies? Let's build a school here. And they did. And their graduates include, well, years later, but Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, was a graduate of the medical school. And they, you know, next time you have surgery and you don't feel any pain because of the anesthesia, you can thank the Scots.
Yeah. And who was it who invented the anesthetic?
Well, it was a doctor named James Simpson who discovered chloroform as an antiseptic, anesthetic. And the way he did that was, it was actually at a dinner party at his house, and he invited a bunch of friends over, and he offered them a decanter of this strange-looking liquid. And apparently, if you're a Scot and you're offered a liquid of any kind, you don't turn it down. So, true story, they all drank it, and the next morning, the maid found everyone passed out but still alive. And Simpson knew he was onto something.
Yeah.
You know, if he had used any less, they wouldn't have felt the effect. If he had used any more, he would have killed all his friends.
Right.
So they got lucky, too.
So that could not have happened anywhere else but Scotland.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about genius. It really is rooted in time and place. It grows in certain soils, and that's what my book's about is, you know, what was in the water back then, and, you know, can we bottle it?
Yeah. And actually, you know, in Scotland, they didn't really make any advances until the British annexed them. So, you know, maybe...
I know. Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
I mean, you would think that they would have just, you know...
So the next big genius hotspot, Crimea. Right? Because the Russians annexed them, so you got to expect big things from Crimea next is what I'm thinking.
You never know, but yeah. I'm placing my money on Estonia, actually.
Yeah, Estonia.
No, did you know that Skype was invented in Estonia?
No, I didn't. I thought that was a joke.
Yeah, and don't laugh. If Estonia were a stock, I'd buy it.
Yeah. Well, where then? Now, Scotland seems to be unique. Oh, by the way, and Scottish writers, you got to love Scottish writers, too. Even modern day ones as well, because they're so down and out, and yet they're up.
Exactly. They've got that combination of pessimism and optimism.
Oh, a horrible pessimism and degradation and down as far down as you can get. And I love it. You know, it's great reading. But then somehow it's still up. It's still a positive in the end somehow.
That you just summed up the Scott character beautifully.
Yeah. I should really... You feel like you're partly Scottish, don't you? I got the feeling from what you read.
A little bit.
Yeah, is there a Scott in the family line? Somewhere?
No Scots in the family. I'm probably part Scottish, part Indian, because that's the other country I love is India.
Yeah.
So, wouldn't it be nice if we just became the countries we visited, or at least the ones we wanted to?
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Well, this geography thing is a good thing for you, because you get to deduct all your travel expenses, right? Because you're writing a book about where you're going. Is that how it started?
Yes, it's true. And if the IRS is listening, I do have receipts. I get receipts for everything. I know how to ask for a receipt in like 17 languages. All I can say.
How do you get in to see everybody? Like you go to China and you see Jack Ma, who's got Alibaba, this guy, financial genius.
Have you heard of the term Guan Xi?
No, what is that?
Okay, that's in the book too.
Yeah.
it is essentially connections.
Oh yeah.
And you need Guan Xi. You need Guan Xi to get anything done in China.
Yeah.
So I knew a friend of a friend of a friend of Jack Ma, which was my inn. You've got to do that. And he was happy to talk to me because I wasn't interested in his $27 billion or you know, reporting about his company, Alibaba. I was interested in what he had to say about Chinese creativity, which he was happy to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah, but did he really say anything? I mean, I tried to get something out of that, but I'm not sure that I did. Did you learn something from Jack Ma about creativity?
First of all, what I learned about him is that he's sort of a hybrid of American ingenuity and Chinese conservatism, if you will. You know, he grew up just when China was opening up to the outside world, and he would hang out at the Shangri-La Hotel and offer free services as a tour guide in exchange for English lessons from the foreign visitors. And I think he must have been infected in a way with that American gumption because the company started as very American. Now, he is as confused as everyone in a way about why China isn't more inventive today, since it has this long history of inventiveness. He thinks, you know, he told me, and it was a surprising answer, that the Chinese need to return to their spiritual roots, Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism. And that surprised me because usually you can't talk about religion in China and get away with it unless you're worth $27 billion.
That helps. That helps anywhere, I think.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Its freedom of speech is there if you can afford it.
Yeah, and didn't he also blame the schools? This
exam-ridden
Chinese educational system.
The exam system, which began centuries ago as a sort of meritocratic thing, you know, no longer you rely on your connections, you had to do well in the exams, has become become an obsession for young Chinese and Korean students, really. They cram for these exams, and they learn everything by rote, and talk about teaching to the test. That's all they do. And so, there is this innovation gap is what they call it in China, and they wring their hands about it. And I was watching a TV show on Chinese television in English so I can understand it, and they were... I had a panel on what should we do about the innovation gap, and one person said, well, we need a government innovation program the way the government has a high-speed rail or highway program, and everyone harumphed an agreement, but that's not the way these things work. Very rarely does the government dictate innovation and say we're going to be innovative, and everyone is. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, have they set up something like? Wasn't it in Russia where they set up? They wanted to set up a Sunnyvale, California.
Yeah, well,
Russian.
Not just Russia, but all over the world.
Yeah, so it must be happening.
There have been hundreds of attempts to replicate Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And they all fail because it's a culture, really, and you can't just transplant a culture.
But I mean, isn't sort of a cliche to say about China is not inventive? Because first of all major inventions of the world came from China originally, and obviously,
but in
recent years maybe not. They started copying and selling that sort of thing. But aren't they past the copying thing now, where it is once again all the stuff is coming from China now?
Well,
or is that not true?
Yeah, it's not entirely true in terms of patents and real creative breakthroughs. What they tell me in China is they bemoan the fact that everything's made in China, but very little is invented there. You know, where's the Steve Jobs of China?
Yeah.
I suppose Jack Ma may come the closest.
Yeah.
But I think they may be on the verge of something. And look, the Chinese take a cyclical view of history in a way that we don't. We have a very linear view.
Yeah.
So they've had these up and down cycles over centuries, and they take the long view. And, you know, don't think that just because the place is up now, it's going to stay up, or if it's down, it's going to stay down. Silicon Valley may not last forever. I know people find that shocking, but look at Detroit, other cities.
And then you go to India, and India is what they say, where chaos begins or something, right? Or chaos reigns.
In their creation myth, in the beginning there was chaos, and it was good.
Yeah.
And there still is chaos in India if you visit it and walk down the street. But Calcutta was a really hot spot for creative genius for a while, and I realize that's kind of surprising. But what
came out of Calcutta in terms
of? The first non-Westerner to win the Nobel Prize for literature, a man named Tagore, Rabindranath Tagore, who's a real Renaissance man in every way. A lot of science, more books were published than any city in the world except for London, tons of literature as well. It's interesting because it really speaks to this connection between messiness, you know, chaos, and creativity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you a neat desk person or a messy desk person?
Yeah. You're asking me, or is that just a general question?
It's for you. Yeah, good question.
I'm like a no desk person.
No desk?
I just write notes on my lap, usually.
Okay, are the notes neat, or is it?
No, you want to see them? I can show you what I got here on our discussion, and no one could ever decipher that. So.
Well, studies show that if you're surrounded with a little bit of mess and chaos, you'll think more creatively than in a neat, perfectly pristine office setting.
Yeah, because you have to figure out what you're doing among all that.
Yeah, I guess so. Look at Einstein's desk was a mess, never mind his hair. Beethoven was a total slob. He kept getting kicked out of his apartments in the end of it. He was a landlord's nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would be so into composing his music that if he needed a bath, he would just douse himself with water right in the living room. And they didn't really like that. But yeah, there's and
you can yell at him all you want. He's deaf. He's not going to hear it.
Exactly. Yeah. But the ladies loved him. He was a real ladies' man.
That's how
Beethoven was. Yeah.
Yeah.
So a little bit of messiness is actually good, because if you think about it, when you're being creative, you have to sort of enter this chaotic state, what one neuroscientist calls an I don't know state. And your EEG actually gets chaotic when you're, say, presented with a new odor or something you haven't been exposed to before.
Yeah.
So between patterns is chaos, and chaos can be good.
Yeah.
So here's the chaos.
Let's go back to Calcutta for just a minute.
Yeah.
You do digressions very well, I gotta say. In your book too, because you're in India, and you suddenly you're quoting Brian Eno and how to apply it, you know. So that's good. I like that. I'm also very digressive. Don't you think that's a sign of genius too? Digressive.
Oh, absolutely.
Tangential thinking has got to be.
Yeah, your mind cannot be contained in corridors. Yeah.
No, not mine anyway.
Yeah, if
can't keep my mind in a corridor.
Yeah, if there's one takeaway from the book, it's that you are a true genius.
Yeah. In
back
India,
to Calcutta.
So is India perhaps the spot where genius, the next big enlightenment, will come from?
I'm pretty I'm bullish on India, along with Estonia. I think
and
India has the freedom of discourse that China doesn't. And even though they are behind China economically, I think they could catch up, and they could catch up in the creative realms. They've already demonstrated that. The software work they do there, a lot of that is quite creative. I'm pretty optimistic about India. But, you know, it's really, everyone wants to know where the next, you know, golden age is going to be. And, you know, if I knew that, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. I'd be on my yacht in the Mediterranean sipping a drink with an umbrella. Or maybe I would still have time.
How would that enrich you, just knowing that? I don't quite.
If you could, first of all, you can buy the right stocks.
Oh, okay.
Second of all, if you could engineer a place of genius, that's the question everyone wants to know. Can you make a place like that?
Yeah.
And I wish I could say yes, but the answer is no. But you can do certain things. You cannot be North Korea, for instance. That's helpful. Don't be North Korea, because it's not going to be the next place of genius, because it's a closed system. You know.
Yeah. What about you know, individual genius? Now that does that still is it just Elon Musk, the only one that we have who's an actual certified genius? Contemporary style, or I mean, where is there such a thing anymore? You know, because that's sort of our Western ideal, whatever. The individual genius is that.
Yeah, it's a legend and a myth, and we love the idea of it so much, don't we? That Elon Musk somehow just comes from outer space, literally, and lands here. But of course, that's not the case. And you know, have you ever wondered why our geniuses are all in the high tech field? Why is it Elon Musk and Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah.
Where are the Beethovens and Mozarts? You know, did the sort of gene pool for classical music dry up?
Yeah.
And the answer is no. The answer is simply, you know, as I can I quote from Plato on your show?
Please do.
Okay, you probably encourage it. Yeah, what Plato said is what is honored in a country will be cultivated there.
Yeah.
And that says it all.
You get the genius you deserve.
Exactly. Yeah. And we don't care much for classical music, so we don't get a Beethoven or Mozart, but we care an awful lot for these gadgets and for electric cars, so we get an Elon Musk or a Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't come from outer space. They're very much grown in our backyard.
Yeah. But also, how depressing is that? That's pretty depressing. Because there are all these other areas that could really use a genius. You know.
Right.
Let's say global warming. Where is the global warming genius?
Well, is it depressing or are you just depressive? Because
both.
You know, we can change, right? If we look at genius as sort of a common enterprise that we're all in, and if we care enough about climate change, then we'll see a climate change genius. I really do believe that.
Yeah.
So I would take away, I'll be a little more optimistic about it.
I'm trying. You're helping.
Too.
No, you're helping a lot. I appreciate
that.
I
think to do anything creative, like write a book, for instance, you can't be a total nihilist. You have to be a little bit optimistic, or why bother writing it? You know, you have to believe if you put pen to paper that someone will read it, and that before you know it, someday, if you're lucky, you'll be on Wisconsin Public Radio talking about it.
Yeah.
You can dream.
I noticed Wisconsin didn't turn up in the book.
Yeah, that was an oversight.
In terms of geography of genius, I didn't see anything. Stevens Point or...
Well, there'll be a follow-up
Madison,
book,
let's say.
All about Wisconsin.
Follow-up, yeah.
Yeah, about... I'm sorry for that oversight.
Maybe in the geography of cheese, when that comes up.
There's an idea for a book.
Of cheeses.
Take you around the world.
Geography
yeah.
of cheeses.
Yeah. You know about the cheesemakers, blessed are the cheesemakers from...
No.
Monty Python's movie. Yeah,
oh.
They said, "Blessed are the cheesemakers." What's so special about the cheesemakers? He said, "Peacemakers." Oh, I've got no more. I have one more cheese joke. Can I throw it in?
Please do.
Did you hear about the explosion in the fromage factory? Debris was everywhere. Ooh.
Well, I hate to end that way, but we're going to.
Oh, that's a big.
Eric, the book is called The Geography of Genius. Thanks so much for talking with us. It was very interesting, and the book is you should pick it up and read it. Because
you
could be a genius and discover it through this book. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you. Take care.
My pleasure. Geography of Genius, Eric Weiner.